And Winkler? What can one think, Bernard? A technician sent in to repair the transmitter if it developed problems? A supervisor to check on progress? Either way, I think we should let him report back that everything is in order. And the big fish, you think he might show up personally?
Sir Nigel shrugged again. His personal fear was that Brian Harcourt Smith, balked of his intended arrest at Sheffield, would try to engineer the storming of the Chesterfield house. For Sir Nigel, this would be wholly premature.
I should have thought there has to be a contact there somewhere. Either he comes to the Greeks or they go to him, he said.
You know something, Nigel? I think we should stake out that house in Chesterfield, at least for a while.
The chief of the SIS looked grave. Bernard, old friend, I happen to agree with you. But your young Brian seems very gung-ho to move in and make a few arrests. He tried last night at Sheffield. Of course, arrests look good for a while, but...
You leave Brian Harcourt Smith to me, Nigel, said Sir Bernard grimly. I may be pegging out, but there's a bark left on the old dog yet. You know, I'm going to take over the direction of this operation personally.
Sir Nigel leaned forward and placed his hand over Sir Bernard's forearm. I really wish you would, Bernard.
Winkler left the house in Compton Street at 9:30, on foot. Mungo and Barney slipped out of the rear of the Roystons' house, through the gardens, and picked up the cheque on the corner of Ashgate Road. He went back to the station, took the London train, and was picked up at St. Pancras by a fresh team. Mungo and Barney went back to Derbyshire. Winkler never returned to his boarding-house. Whatever he had left there, he abandoned, like the grip on the train with pyjamas and shirt, and went straight to Heathrow. He caught the afternoon flight out to Vienna. Irvin's head of station in Vienna later reported he was met by two men from the Soviet embassy.
Preston spent the rest of the day closeted in the police station, attending to the wealth of administrative detail involved in a stakeout in the provinces. The bureaucratic machine ground into action. Charles Street jacked up the Home Office, who authorised the Chief Constable of Derbyshire to instruct Superintendent King to afford Preston and his men every cooperation. Mr. King was happy to do so anyway, but the paperwork had to be in order. Len Stewart, with a second team, came up by car and were billeted in police bachelor quarters. Photos were taken with a long lens of both Greek brothers as they left Compton Street for their taverna at Holywell Cross just before noon, and dispatched by motorcycle to London. Other experts came in from Manchester, went into the local telephone exchange, and put a tap on both the Greeks' phones, at the house and the taverna. A direction finder bleeper was slipped into their car. By late afternoon, London had a make on the Greeks. They were not true Cypriots, but they were brothers, veteran Greek communists, once active in the Elas movement. They had left mainland Greece for Cyprus 20 years earlier. Athens had therefore kindly informed London that their real name was Kostopoulos. From Cyprus, according to Nicosia, they had vanished 8 years earlier. Immigration records at Croydon informed that the Stefanides brothers had entered Britain 5 years before as legitimate Cypriot citizens and been permitted to stay. Records in Chesterfield showed they had arrived there just 3.5 years earlier from London, taken a long lease on the kebab house, and bought the small terrace residence in Compton Street. Since then they had lived as peaceful and law-abiding citizens. 6 days a week they opened their taverna for the lunch trade, which was slack, and stayed open until late, when they did a thriving trade in takeaway suppers. Nobody in the police station, except Superintendent King, was told the real reason for the stakeout, and only 6 were told at all. The others were informed it was part of a nationwide drugs bust operation. London people were only being brought in because they knew the faces. Just after sundown, Preston cleared up at the police headquarters and went to join Birkinshaw and his team. Before leaving the police station, he thanked Superintendent King profusely for all the latter's assistance to him.
"Are you going to sit in during the stakeout?" asked the police chief.
"Yes, I'll be there," said Preston. "Well, why do you ask?"
Superintendent King smiled sadly.
"Half of last night we had a very aggrieved railway porter downstairs.
It seems someone knocked him off his moped in the station yard and made off on it. We found the moped in Foljam Road, quite undamaged. Still, he gave us a very clear description of his assailant. You won't be going out much, will you?
No, I shouldn't think so.
How very wise, suggested Superintendent King.
At his house in Compton Street, Mr. Royston had been urged to continue his normal routine, visiting the shops in the morning and the bowling green in the afternoon. Extra food and drink would be brought in after dark, in case neighbours wondered at the Roystons' sudden and vastly increased appetite. A small television was brought in for what Mr. Royston termed the lads upstairs, and they all settled down to wait and watch. The Roystons had moved into the back bedroom, and the single bed from that room was brought to the front. It would be shared in shifts by the watchers. Also brought in was a powerful set of binoculars. An easy chair, sipping a cup of fresh-brewed tea. Harry Birkinshaw was sitting like a Buddha in an armchair behind the lace curtains, gazing across at the empty house. A man who had spent half his life standing in the rain, he was quite content. He was warm, dry, had a large supply of mints, and his shoes off. There were worse ways, he well knew. The target house even backed onto a 15-foot concrete wall, the football ground, which meant no one need spend the night crouched in the bushes. Preston took the spare chair beside him, behind the mounted camera, and accepted a cup of tea from Ginger. "Are you bringing up the covert entry team?" Harry asked. He meant the skilled burglars the technical services maintained for clandestine break-ins. "No," said Preston. "For one thing, we don't even know there might not be someone in there as well. For another, there could be a range of warning devices to indicate if an entry has taken place, and we might not spot them all. Finally, what I'm waiting for is a chummy to show up. When he does, we take the cars and tail him. Len can take over the house." They settled down in companionable silence. Barney woke up.
"Anything on the telly?"
he asked. "Not much," said Ginger. "The evening news, usual rubbish."
24 hours later, on the Thursday evening at the same hour, the news was quite interesting. On their small screen they saw the Prime Minister standing on the steps of No. 10 Downing Street in a neat blue suit, facing a horde of press and television crews. She announced she had returned from Buckingham Palace, where she had asked for a dissolution of Parliament. In consequence, the country would prepare for a general election to be held on the 18th of June next. The rest of the evening was devoted to the sensation, with the leaders and luminaries of all the parties announcing their confident expectation of victory.
"Turn up for the book," Birkinshaw remarked to Preston. He could get no reply. Preston watched the screen, lost in thought. At last he said, "I think I've got it."
"Well, don't use our loo," said Mungo.
"What's that, John?" asked Harry when the laughter died down.
"My deadline," said Preston, but he refused to elaborate.
By 1987, very few European-manufactured cars still retained the old-style large round headlights, but one that did was the evergreen Austin Mini. It was a vehicle of this type that was among the many cars to disembark on the evening of the 2nd of June from the Cherbourg ferry arriving at Southampton. The car had been bought in Austria 4 weeks earlier, driven to the clandestine garage in Germany, modified there, and driven back to Salzburg. The car had perfect Austrian papers, as did the tourist driving it, though he was in fact Czech, the second and last of the contributions by the STB to Major Volkov's plan to import into Britain the components Valery Pietrovsky needed. The Mini was searched at customs, and nothing amiss was discovered. Clearing Southampton docks, the driver followed the London directions until, in the northern suburbs of the port city, he pulled off the road into a large car park. It was quite dark already, and at the rear of the park he was out of sight of those still speeding down the main highway. He descended, and with a screwdriver began to work on the headlights. First, he removed the chrome ring covering the gap between the headlight unit and the surrounding metal of the car's wing. Using a larger screwdriver, he then undid the screws holding the headlight unit firmly inside the wing. When they came free, He eased the entire headlight unit out of its socket, detached the electric flexes running from the car's electrical system into the rear of the lamp bowl, and laid the unit, which appeared exceptionally heavy, in a canvas bag by his side. It took almost an hour to extract both headlamp units. When he had finished, the small car stared sightlessly ahead with empty sockets. In the morning, the agent knew, he would return with freshly purchased headlights from Southampton, fit them, and drive away. For the moment, he hefted the heavy canvas bag, went back to the high road, and walked 300 yards back towards the port. The bus stop was where they had said it would be. He checked his watch, 10 minutes to rendezvous. Exactly 10 minutes later, a man in motorcycle leathers strolled up to the bus stop. There was no one else there. The newcomer glanced down the road and remarked, "It's always a long wait for the last bus of the night." The Czech sighed with relief.
"Yes," he replied, "but thank God I should be home by midnight."
They waited in silence until the bus into Southampton arrived. The Czech left the grip on the ground and boarded the bus. As the taillights disappeared towards the city, the motorcyclist lifted the grip and walked away, back up the road to the roadside housing estate, where he had left his motorcycle. By dawn, having ridden to Thetford to change and switch vehicles, he arrived home in Cherry Hayes Close, Ipswich, carrying the last of the scheduled list of components he had waited for these long weeks. Courier 9 had delivered. 2 days later, the stakeout on the house in Compton Street, Chesterfield, was 1 week old and had absolutely nothing to report. The two Greek brothers lived lives of impeccable uneventfulness. They rose about 9, busied themselves about their house, where they appeared to do all their own cleaning and dusting, and left in their 5-year-old saloon car for the restaurant just before midday. They stayed there until close to midnight, when they returned home to sleep. There were no visitors and few phone calls. What calls there were involved orders for meat and vegetables or other harmless sundries. Down at the Taverna and Holywell Cross, Len Stewart and his people reported much the same. The telephone was used more frequently, but again the talk was of orders for food, bookings for a table, or deliveries of wine. It was not possible for a watcher to dine there every night. The Greeks were apparently professionals who had spent years in the clandestine life and would have spotted a customer who came too frequently or loitered too long. But Stewart and his team did their best. For the team in the Royston house, the main problem was boredom. Even Mr. and Mrs. Royston were tiring of the inconvenience caused by their presence after the initial excitement had worn off. Mr. Royston had agreed to volunteer as a canvasser for the Conservative Party. He resolutely declined to assist anybody else, and the front windows of the house now bore posters in favour of the local Tory candidate. This enabled more coming and going than usual, since anyone with a Conservative rosette seen leaving or entering the house would attract no attention from the neighbours. The ruse enabled Birkinshaw and his team, suitably rosetted, to take an occasional stroll while the Greeks were at their restaurant. It broke the monotony. The only one who seemed immune from boredom was Harry Birkinshaw himself. For the rest, the principal distraction was the television, kept at low volume, particularly when the Roystons were out, and the prime topic day and evening was the continued election campaign. 1 week into the campaign, 3 things were becoming clear. The Liberal Social Democrat alliance had still failed to surge in the opinion polls, and the issue seemed to be increasingly developing into the traditional race between the Conservatives and the Labour Party. The second factor was that all public opinion polls indicated the two main parties were much closer than could have been foreseen 4 years earlier in 1983 when the Conservatives won their landslide. Further, constituency-level polling indicated that the outcome in the 80 most marginal constituencies would almost certainly decide the colour of the country's next government. In every poll, it was the floating vote, varying between 10 and 20%, that held the balance. The third development was that, despite all the economic and ideological issues involved, and despite the efforts of all parties to make the most of them, the campaign was becoming increasingly dominated by the much more emotive issue of unilateral nuclear disarmament. In more and more polls, the nuclear arms race issue was showing as first or second priority of concern.
The pacifist movements, broadly left and broadly united for once, were mounting what was in effect a parallel campaign of their own. Huge demonstrations took place on an almost daily basis, rewarded with equally copious coverage by press and TV. The movements, while demonstrating no noticeable fundraising organisation, seemed able, from their combined resources, to hire hundreds of coaches at commercial rates to transport their demonstrators hither and thither across the land. Hard-left luminaries of the Labour Party, agnostics or atheists to a man, shared every public or TV platform with clerics of the trendier wing of the Anglican Church, where the members of the two groups spent their allocated airtime nodding in grave agreement with the points made by the other. Inevitably, even though the alliance was not unilateralist, the primary target of the disarmers was the Conservative Party, just as their primary ally became the Labour Party. The Labour leader, supported by the National Executive, seeing which way the wind was blowing, publicly aligned himself and the party to every one of the unilateralist demands. Another theme that ran through the left campaign was anti-Americanism. On 100 platforms, it rapidly became impossible for the interviewer or show host to extract a single condemnatory word from the disarmer's spokesman against Soviet Russia. The constantly reiterated theme was of hatred of America, portrayed as the warmonger, the imperialist, and the threat to peace. On Thursday, the 4th of June, the campaign was enlivened by the sudden Soviet offer to guarantee the whole of Western Europe, neutrals and NATO nations alike, a nuclear-free zone in perpetuity, if America would do the same. An attempt by the British Defence Minister to explain that A, the removal of European US defences was verifiable, while Soviet warhead de-targeting was not, and B, that the Warsaw Pact had a 4-to-1 conventional weapon superiority over NATO, was howled down twice before lunch, and the ministers had to be removed from the grip of the pacifists by bodyguards. "Anyone would think," grumbled Harry Birkinshaw as he popped another mint, "that this election was a national referendum on nuclear disarmament." "It is," said Preston shortly. Friday found Major Piotrowski shopping in Ipswich town centre. From a hardware store, he bought a light, short-handled, two-wheeled trolley of the type used for shifting sacks, dustbins, or heavy suitcases. A builder's merchant yielded 2 10-foot planks. In an office equipment shop, he acquired a small steel filing cabinet, 30 inches tall, 18 wide, and 12 deep, with a door that locked securely. A timber store provided a variety of lathes, battens, and short joists, while a do-it-yourself shop sold him a complete toolbox, including a high-speed drill with a selection of bits for steel or timber, plus nails, bolts, nuts, screws, and a pair of heavy-duty industrial gloves. From a packaging warehouse he bought a quantity of foam insulation, and he rounded off the morning in an electrical emporium with the purchase of 4 cubic 9-volt batteries and a selection of multicoloured single-flex wiring. It took 2 journeys in his hatchback saloon car to bring the loads back to Cherry Hayes Close, where he stored them in the garage. After dark, he brought most of the gear inside the house. That night, the radio told him, in Morse, the details of the arrival of the assembler, the one event he had not been required to memorise. It would be Rendezvous X, and the date Monday the 8th. Tight, he thought. Damn tight. But he would still be on target. While Piotrowski was crouched over his one-time pad deciphering the message, and the Greeks were serving moussaka and kebab to the queue of people who had just quit the nearby bars at closing time, Preston was in the police station, on the phone to Sir Bernard Hemmings.
"The question is, John, how long can we keep going up there in Chesterfield without any results?" said Sir Bernard.
"It's only been a week, sir," said Preston.
"The stakeouts have lasted a lot longer."
"Yes, I well know that. The thing is, we usually have more to go on. There's a growing move here that advocates crashing in on the Greeks to see what it is they've got stashed away in that house, if anything. Why won't you agree a clandestine entry while they're at work?"
"Because I think they're top pros, and they'd spot they'd been done over. If that happened, they probably have a foolproof way of warning off their controller from ever visiting them again."
"Yes, I suppose you're right.
it's all very well you sitting over that house like a tethered goat in India waiting for the tiger to come, but supposing the tiger doesn't show?
I believe he will, sooner or later, Sir Bernard, said Preston. Please, give me a bit more time.
All right, conceded Hemmings after a pause for a consultation at the other end. A week, John. Next Friday I'll have to jack up the special branch lads to go in there and take the place apart. Let's face it, the man you're looking for could be inside there all the time. I don't believe he is. Winkler would never have visited the lair of the tiger himself. I believe he's still out there somewhere, and that he'll come.
Very well. 1 week, John. Friday next it is.
Sir Bernard hung up. Preston stared at the handset. The election was 13 days away. He was beginning to feel dejected, that he could have been wrong all along. Nobody else, with the possible exception of Sir Nigel, believed in his hunch. A small disc of polonium and a low-level Czech bagman were not much to go on, and might not even be linked.
All right, Sir Bernard, he told the buzzing handset. 1 week. After that, I'm jacking it in anyway.
The Finnair jet from Helsinki arrived the following Monday afternoon, on time, as usual, and its complement of passengers passed through Heathrow without undue problems. One of them was a tall, bearded man of middle age whose Finnish passport claimed him to be Urho Nuutila, and whose fluent command of the language could be partly explained by his Karelian parentage. He was, in fact, a Russian, called Vasiliev, and by profession a scientist in nuclear engineering, attached to the Soviet Army Artillery Ordnance Research Directorate. Like most Finns, he spoke passable English. Having cleared customs, he took the airport courtesy coach to the Heathrow Penta Hotel, walked in through the front, kept going right past reception, and emerged at the rear door, giving on to the car park. He waited by that door in the late afternoon sunshine, unnoticed by anyone, until a small hatchback saloon drew abreast of him. The driver had his window open. "Is this where the coaches from the airport drop the passengers?" he asked.
"No," said the traveller. "I think that is round the front."
"Where are you from?" asked the young man.
"Finland, actually," said the bearded one.
"It must be cold in Finland."
"No, at this time of year it is very hot. The main problem is the mosquitoes."
The young man nodded. Vasiliev walked around the car and climbed in. They drove off.
"Name?"
asked Piotrowski.
"Vasiliev."
"That'll do. Nothing more.
I'm Ross."
"Far to go?"
asked Vasiliev.
"About 2 hours."
They drove the rest of the way in silence. Piotrowski made 3 separate manoeuvres to detect a tail, had there been one. There was not. They arrived at Cherry Hayes Close by the last light of day. On the next-door patch of front lawn, his neighbour, Mr. Armitage, was mowing the grass.
"Company,"
he said, as Vasiliev descended from the car and walked to the front door. Piotrowski took the man's single small case from the back and winked at Armitage.
"Head office," he whispered. "Best behaviour. Might get promotion." "Oh, I should think so, then," grinned Armitage.
He nodded in encouragement and went on mowing. Inside the sitting room, Piotrowski closed the curtains, as he always did, before putting on the light. Vasiliev stood motionless in the gloom.
"Right," he said when the lights went on. "To business. Have you got all the 9 consignments that were sent to you?"
"Yes, all 9.
"Let's confirm them. 1 child's play ball, weighing about 20 kilograms.
Check.
1 pair of shoes, 1 box cigars, 1 plaster cast.
Check.
1 transistor radio, 1 electric shaver, 1 steel tube, extremely heavy.
That must be this." Piotrowski went to a cupboard and held up a short length of heavy metal in heat-resistant cladding.
"It is," said Vasiliev.
"Finally, 1 handheld fire extinguisher, unusually heavy, and 1 pair car headlamps, also very heavy.
Check."
"Oh, that's it, then. If you've got the rest of the innocent commercial purchases, I'll start assembling in the morning."
"Why not now?"
"Look, young man,
First, the sawing and the drilling is hardly going to please the neighbours at this hour. Secondly, I'm tired. With this kind of toy, you don't make mistakes. I'll start fresh tomorrow and be finished by sundown. Piotrowski nodded. Take the back bedroom. I'll run you to Heathrow on Wednesday in time for the morning flight.
Chapter 21. Vasiliev elected to work in the sitting room, with the curtains closed and by electric light. First he asked for the 9 consignments to be assembled.
"We'll need a garbage bag," he said. Piotrowski fetched him one from the kitchen. "Pass the consignments to me as I ask for them," said the assembler. "First, the cigar box."
He broke open the seals and opened the lid. The box had 2 levels of cigars, 13 on the top and 12 below, each in an aluminium tube.
"It should be 3rd from the left, bottom row."
It was. He emptied the cigar from its tube and slit it open with a razor. From the sliced tobacco inside, he withdrew a slim glass phial with a crimped end and 2 twisted wires sticking out. An electric detonator. The waste went into the bag.
"Blaster cast."
The case had been made in 2 layers, the first allowed to harden before the second was applied. Between the 2 layers, a sheet of grey, putty-like substance had been rolled flat, encased in polythene to prevent adhesion, and wrapped around the arm. Vasiliev prized the 2 layers of plaster of Paris apart, peeled the grey plasticine from its cavity, pulled away the polythene protector sheets, and rolled it back into a ball. 0.5 pound of plastic explosive. Given Mr. Lichka's shoes, he cut away the heels of both. From one, a steel disc, 2 inches in diameter, 1 inch thick. Its rim was threaded to turn it into a broad, flat screw, and one surface had a deep cut to take a wide-headed screwdriver. From the other heel came a flatter 2-inch disc of grey metal. It was of lithium, an inert metal that, when bonded during the explosion to the polonium, would form the initiator and cause the atomic reaction to reach its full force. The complementary disc of polonium came from the electric shaver that had so worried Karol Wozniak and replaced the one lost up in Glasgow. There were 5 of the smuggled consignments left. The heat-resistant cladding from the Hanomag truck exhaust pipe was stripped away to reveal a steel tube weighing 20 kilograms. It had an internal diameter of 2 inches, external 4 inches, for the metal's thickness was 1 inch, and it was of hardened steel. One end was flanged and threaded internally, the other capped in steel. The capping had a small hole in the centre, capable of allowing the electric detonator to be passed through it. From First Officer Romanov's transistor radio, Vasiliev extracted the timer device, a flat, sealed steel box the size of 2 cigarette packs, end to end. It had 2 large round buttons on one face, red and yellow. From the other face protruded 2 coloured wires, negative and positive. Each corner had an ear-like lug with a hole for bolting to the outside of the steel cabinet that would contain the bomb. Taking the fire extinguisher from Mr. Lundqvist's Saab, the assembler unscrewed the base, which the preparation team had cut open, reassembled, and repaired to hide the seam. Out of the interior came not fire damper foam, but wadding, and last of all, a heavy rod of lead-like metal, 5 inches long and 2 inches in diameter. Small though it was, it still weighed 4.5 kilograms. Vasiliev pulled out the heavy gloves to handle it. It was pure uranium-235. "Isn't that stuff radioactive?" asked Piotrowski, who had watched in fascination.
"Yes, but not dangerously so. People think all radioactive materials are dangerous to the same level. Not so. Luminous watches are radioactive, but we wear them. Uranium is an alpha emitter, low level. Now, plutonium, that's really lethal. So is this stuff when it gets critical. It will just before detonation, but not yet."
The pair of headlamps from the Mini took a lot of stripping. Vasiliev took out the glass lamps, the filament inside, and the inner reflector bowl. What he was left with was a pair of extremely heavy semi-spherical bowls, each of 1 inch thick hardened steel. Each bowl had a flange around its rim, drilled with 16 holes to take the nuts and bolts. Joined together, they would form a perfect globe. One of the bowls had at its base a 2-inch wide hole, threaded inside to accept the steel plug from Lichka's left shoe. The other had a short stump of tube sticking from its base, internally 2 inches wide and flanged and threaded on its outer side to screw into the steel gun tube from the Hanomag's exhaust system. The last item was the child's ball, brought in by the camper van. Vasiliev cut away the bright rubberized skin. A ball of metal gleamed in the light.
"That's lead wrapping," he said. "The ball of uranium, the fissionable core of the nuke, is inside. I'll get it out later. It's also radioactive, like that piece over there."
Having satisfied himself he had his 9 components, he started work on the steel filing cabinet. Turning it on its back, he lifted the lid, and with the timber lathes and battens prepared an inner frame in the form of a low cradle which rested on the floor of the chest. This he covered with a thick layer of shock-absorbent foam rubber.
"I'll pack more around the sides and over the top when the bomb's inside," he explained.
Taking the 4 batteries, he wired them up, terminal to terminal, then lashed them into a block with masking tape. Finally, he bored 4 small holes in the lid of the cabinet and wired the block of batteries inside the lid. It was midday.
"Right," he said. "Let's put the device together. By the way, have you ever seen a nuke?"
"No," said Petrovsky hoarsely. He was an expert in unarmed combats, unafraid of fists, knives, or guns, but the cold-blooded joviality of Vasiliev as he handled enough destructive power to flatten a town worried him. Like most people, he regarded nuclear science as an occult art.
"Once they were very complicated," said the assembler, "very large, even the low-power ones, and could only be made under extremely complex laboratory conditions. Today, the really sophisticated ones, the multi-megaton hydrogen weapons, still are. But the basic atomic bomb today has been simplified to a point where it can be assembled on just about any workbench, given the right parts, of course, and a bit of caution and know-how."
"Great," said Petrovsky. Vasiliev was cutting away the thin lead sheeting round the ball of uranium-235. The lead had been wrapped around cold, like wrapping paper, and its seams blazed with a blowtorch to seal them. It came apart quite easily. Inside was the inner ball, 5 inches in diameter, with a 2-inch wide hole drilled straight through the middle.
"Want to know how it works?" asked Vasiliev.
"Sure."
"This ball is uranium. Weight, 15.5 kilograms. Not enough mass to have reached criticality. Uranium goes critical as its mass increases beyond criticality point."
"What is critical?"
"It starts to fizz. Not literally, like lemonade. I mean, fizz in radioactive terms. It passes to the threshold of detonation. This ball is not yet at that stage. See that short rod over there?"
"Yes."
It was the uranium rod from the hollow fire extinguisher. "That rod will fit exactly into the 2-inch hole in the center of this ball. When it does, the whole mass will go critical. The steel tube over there is like a gun barrel with the uranium rod as the bullet. In detonation, the plastic explosive will blast the rod down the tube and into the heart of this ball."
"And it goes bang?"
"Not quite. You need the initiator. Left to itself, the uranium would fizz into extinction, create a hell of a lot of radioactivity, but no explosion. To get the bang, you have to bombard the critical uranium with a blizzard of neutrons. Those 2 disks, the lithium and the polonium, form the initiator. Left apart, they're harmless. The polonium is a mild alpha emitter, the lithium is inert. Smash them together, and they do something odd. They start a reaction. They emit that blizzard of neutrons we need. Subjected to this, the uranium tears itself apart in a gigantic release of energy, the destruction of matter. It takes 1/100,000,000th of a second. The steel tamper is to hold it all together for that tiny period."
"Who drops in the initiator?" asked Petrovsky in an attempt at gallows humor.
Vasiliev grinned. "No one. The 2 disks are in there already, but held apart. We put the polonium at one end of the hole in the uranium ball, and the other on the nose of the incoming uranium projectile. The bullet comes down the tube into the heat of the ball, and the lithium on its nose is slammed into the polonium, waiting at the other end of the tunnel.
That's it.
Vasiliev used a drop of superglue to stick the polonium disc to one face of the flat steel plug from Lichka's shoe heel. Then he screwed the plug into the hole at the base of one of the tamper bowls. Taking the uranium ball, he lowered it into the bowl. The interior of that bowl had four nodules which slotted into four indentations cast in the uranium. When they met and engaged, the ball was held in place. Vasiliev took a pencil torch and peered down the hole through the core of the uranium ball. "There it is," he said, waiting at the bottom of the hole. Then he placed the second bowl over the top to form a perfect globe and spent an hour tightening the 16 bolts round the flange to hold the two halves together. "Now, the gun," he remarked. He pushed the plastic explosive down the 18-inch long steel tube, tamping it firmly but gently with a broom handle from the kitchen until it was packed tight. Through the small hole in the base of the tube, Piotrowski could make out the plastic explosive bulging up. With the same superglue, Vasiliev attached the lithium disc to the flat nose of the uranium rod, wrapped it in a tissue to ensure it could not slip back down the tube from vibration, and ran the rod down onto the explosive at the bottom. Then he screwed the tube into the globe. It looked like a grey, 7-inch diameter melon, with an 18-inch handle sticking out from one end, a sort of oversized stick grenade. "Nearly done," said Vasiliev. "The rest is conventional bomb-making." He took the detonator, separated the wires from its end, and insulated each with tape. If they touched each other, there could be a premature detonation. A length of 5-amp flex was twisted onto each wire from the detonator. Then he pressed the detonator through the hole in the far end of the tube until it was embedded in the plastic explosive. He lowered the bomb, like a baby, onto its foam cradle, packing more foam all round its sides, and yet more over the top, as if it were going to bed. Only the two wires were kept free. One of these was attached to the positive terminal of the battery block. A third wire went from the negative terminal on the batteries, so Vasiliev still had one of each in his hands. He insulated each exposed end. "Just in case they touched each other," he grinned. "Now that would be bad news." The single unused component was the timer box. Vasiliev used the drill to bore 5 holes in the side of the steel filing cabinet near the top. The center hole was for the wires out of the back of the timer, which he fed through. The other 4 were for thin bolts with which he fixed the timer to the exterior of the cabinet. This done, he linked the wires from the batteries and detonator to those from the timer, according to their color coding. Piotrowski held his breath. "Don't worry," said Vasiliev, who had noticed him. "This timer was repeatedly tested back home. The cutout or circuit breaker is inside, and it works." He stowed the last of the wires, insulated the joins heavily, and lowered the lid of the cabinet, locking it securely, and tossing the key to Piotrowski. "So, Comrade Ross, there it is. You can wheel it on the trolley into the rear of the hatchback, and it will not damage it. You can drive where you wish. The vibration will not disturb it. Oh, one last thing. The yellow button here will, if pushed firmly, start the timer, but not complete the electrical circuit. The timer will do that 2 hours later. Press the yellow one, and you have 2 hours to get the hell out. The red one is a manual override. Press that, and you get instant detonation." He did not know he was wrong. He really believed what he had been told. Only 4 men in Moscow knew both buttons were set for instant detonation. It was evening. "Now, friend Ross, I want to eat, drink a little, sleep well, and go home tomorrow morning, if that is all right with you." "Sure," said Piotrowski. "Let's get the cabinet into the corner here, between the sideboard and the drinks table. Help yourself to whiskey. I'll rustle up some supper." They set off for Heathrow at 10 in Piotrowski's small car. At a lay-by, southwest of Colchester, where the dense woods came close to the road, Piotrowski got out to relieve himself. Seconds later, Vasiliev heard his sharp cries of alarm and ran to investigate. He ended his life with an expertly broken neck behind a screen of trees. The body, stripped of all identification, was laid in a shallow ditch and covered with fresh branches. It would probably be discovered in a day or so, maybe more. Police inquiries would eventually involve a photograph in the local papers, which his neighbour Armitage might or might not see, and might or might not recognise. It would be too late anyway. Piotrowski drove back to Ipswich. He had no qualms. His orders had been quite clear on the matter of the assembler. How Vasiliev had ever thought he was going home, he could not imagine. In any case, he had other problems. Everything was ready, but time was short. He had visited Rendlesham Forest and picked his spot, in dense cover, but hardly 100 yards from the perimeter wire of USAF base Bentwaters. There would be no one there at 4 in the morning when he pressed the yellow button to initiate detonation at 6. Fresh branches would cover the cabinet while the minutes ticked away, and while he drove hard towards London. The only thing he did not know was which morning. The signal to go operational would, he knew, come on the Radio Moscow English Language Service news at 10 p.m. the previous evening. It would be in the form of a deliberate word fluff by the newsreader in the first news item. But since Vasiliev could not tell them, Moscow still had to be informed that all was in place. It meant the last message by radio. After that, the Greeks would be dispensable. In the dusk of a warm June evening, he left Cherry Hayes Close and drove sedately north towards Thetford and his motorcycle. At 9, he began to ride northwest into the British Midlands. The boredom of an ordinary evening for the watchers in the upper front room of the Royston House was broken just after 10 when Len Stewart came on the air from the police station. "John, one of my lads was eating in the tavern just now. The phone rang twice, then the caller rang off. It rang again twice, then he rang off again. Then he did it a third time. The listeners confirm it." "Did the Greeks try to answer it?" "They didn't reach it in time the first occasion it rang. After that, they didn't reach for it, just went on serving. Hold on, John, are you there?" "Yes, of course. My people outside report one of the Greeks is leaving, through the back. He's going for his car." "Two cars and 4 men to follow," said Preston, "remaining 2 to stay with the taverna. The runner may be leaving town." But he was not. Andreas Stefanidis drove back to Compton Street, parked the car, and let himself in. Lights went on behind the curtains. Nothing else happened. At 11:20, earlier than usual, Spiridon closed the taverna and walked home, arriving at 11:45. Preston's Tiger came just before the hour of midnight. The street was very quiet. Almost all the lights were doused. Preston had scattered his 4 cars and their crews far and wide, and nobody saw him come. The first they knew, there was a mutter from one of Stewart's men. "There's a man at the top end of Compton Street, junction of Cross Street." "Doing?" asked Preston. "Nothing. Standing motionless in the shadows." "Wait." It was pitch dark in the Royston's upper front room. The curtains were back, the men standing away from the window. Mungo crouched behind the camera, which was wearing its infrared lens. Preston held his small radio close to one ear. Stewart's team of 6 and his own 2 drivers with their cars were out there somewhere, all linked by radio. A door opened down the street as someone put a cat out. It closed again. "He's moving," the radio muttered. "Down towards you, slowly." "Got him," hissed Ginger, who was at one of the side windows of the bay. "Medium height and build, dark long raincoat." "Mungo, can you get him under that streetlight, just before the Greek's house?" asked Birkinshaw. Mungo turned the lens a fraction. "I'm focused on a pool of light," he said. "He's 10 yards short," said Ginger. Without a sound, the figure in the raincoat entered the glimmer cast by the street lamp. Mungo's camera threw off 5 fast exposures. The man passed out of the light and arrived at the gate of the Stefanides house. He went up the short path and tapped, instead of ringing, at the door. It opened at once. There was no light in the hall, The dark raincoat passed inside. The door closed. Across the street, the tension broke. Mungo, get that film out of there and over to the police lab. I want it developed and passed straight to Scotland Yard. Immediate on-pass to Charles and Sentinel. I'll tell them to be ready to try and get a make. Something was bothering Preston. Something about the way the man walked. It was a warm night. Why a raincoat? To keep dry? The sun had shone all day to cover something. Pale clothing. Distinctive clothing. Mungo, what was he wearing? You saw him in close-up. Mungo's halfway out the door. A raincoat, he said. Dark. Long. Under that, Ginger whistled. Boots. Remember them now. 10 inches of jackboot. Shit. He's on a motorcycle, said Preston. He spoke into the radio. Everyone out on the streets, on foot only, no car engine. Every street in the district except Compton Street. We're looking for a motorcycle with a warm engine block. The problem is, he thought, I don't know how long he's going to be there. 5 minutes? 10? 60? He called up Len Stewart. Len, John here. If we get that motorcycle, I want a DF bleeper in it somewhere. Meanwhile, call up Superintendent King. He'll have to mount the operation. When Chummy leaves, we'll be after him. Harry's team and me. I want you to stay with your boys on the Greeks. When we're all 1 hour clear, the police can take the house and the Greeks. Len Stewart, inside the police station, assented and started to phone Superintendent King at home. It was 20 minutes before one of the roving team found the motorcycle. He reported to Preston, still at the Royston house. There's a big BMW, top end of Queen Street. Carrier box behind the pillion, locked. 2 panniers either side of the rear wheel, unlocked. Engine and exhaust still warm. Registration number? The number was given him. He passed it to Len Stewart at the police station. Stewart asked for an immediate make on it. It turned out to be a Suffolk number, registered to a Mr. James Duncan Ross of Dorchester. Either it's a stolen vehicle, false plate, or blind address, muttered Preston. Hours later, the Dorchester police established it was the last of the three. The man who'd found the motorcycle was ordered to plant the bleeper in one of the panniers, switch it on, and get well away from the vehicle. The man, Joe, was one of Birkinshaw's 2 drivers. He went back to his car, effaced himself behind the steering wheel, and confirmed the direction finder was functioning. Okay, said Preston. We're doing a changeover. All drivers back to their cars. Len Stewart's 3 move towards the West Street rear entrance to our observation post and relieve us. One by one. Quietly and now. To the men around him in the room, he said, Harry, pack up. You go first. Take the lead car. I'll join you. Barney, Ginger, take the backup car. If Mungo can join us, he'll ride with me. One by one, Stewart's team arrived through the back to replace Birkinshaw's men. Preston prayed the agent across the road would not move out while the changeover was taking place. He was the last to leave, putting his head round the door of the Roystons' bedroom to thank them for their help and assure them it would all be over by dawn. The whispers that came back were more than a little worried. Preston slipped through the gardens into West Street, and 5 minutes later joined Birkinshaw and Joe, the driver, in their lead car parked down Foljam Road. Ginger and Barney reported in from the second car at the top end of Marsden Street off Saltergate.
Of course, said Birkinshaw gloomily. If it's not the motorcycle, we're up shit creek without a puddle.
Preston was in the back. Beside the driver, Birkinshaw watched the display panel of the console in front of him. Like a small radar screen, it showed a flashing pulse of light at rhythmic intervals, glowing onto a quadrant that gave its direction from the end-to-end axis of the car in which they were sitting, and approximate distance, 0.5 mile. The second car carried the same device, enabling the 2 operators to get a cross bearing if they wished.
"It's got to be the motorcycle," said Preston desperately. "We'd never tail him in these streets anyway. They're too empty and he's too good."
"He's leaving."
The sudden bark from the radio cut off further talk. Stewart's men in the Royston house reported the man in the raincoat had left the door across the street. They confirmed he walked up Compton Street towards Cross Street and in the direction of the BMW. Then he passed out of sight. 2 minutes later, one of Stewart's drivers, behind his windscreen in St. Margaret's Drive, reported the agent had crossed the top of that street, still walking towards Queen Street. Then nothing. 5 minutes went by. Preston prayed.
"He's moving!"
Birkinshaw was jumping up and down his front seat in excitement, most unusual for this phlegmatic watcher. The flashing blip was slowly cruising across the screen as the motorcycle changed the angle between itself and the car. "Target on the move," the second car confirmed. "Give him a mile, then take off," said Preston. "Start engines now."
The blip moved south and east through the centre of Chesterfield. When it was close to the Lord's Mill roundabout, the cars began to follow. When they reached the roundabout, there was no doubt. The signal from the motorcycle was steady and strong, straight down the A617 to Mansfield and Newark. Range just over a mile. Even their lights would be out of sight of the motorcyclist ahead. Joe grinned. "Try and shake us now, you bastard," he remarked.
Preston would have been happier if the man ahead were in a car. Motorcycles were brutes to follow. Fast and manoeuvrable, they could weave between dense traffic that blocked a trailing car, drive down narrow alleys or between bollards that no car could enter. Even out in the country, they could leave the road and ride over grassland where a car would be hard put to follow. The essence was to keep the man ahead unaware they were following. The motorcyclist up ahead was good. He stayed within the speed limit, but seldom came below it, taking the bends without slackening speed. He kept to the A617 beneath the sweep of the M1 motorway, through Mansfield, asleep in the small hours of the morning, and on towards Newark. Derbyshire gave way to the fat, rich farmland of Nottinghamshire, and he never slackened pace. Just before Newark, he stopped.
"Range closing fast," said Joe suddenly. "Douse lights, pull over," snapped Preston.
In fact, Piotrowski had swerved into a side road, killed his engine and lights, and now sat at the junction, staring back the way he had come. A big truck thundered past him and vanished towards Newark. Nothing else. A mile up the road, the two watcher cars held station by the roadside. Piotrowski stayed still for 5 minutes, then gunned his engine and went off down the road to the southeast. When they saw the flashing light and the console move away, the watchers followed, always keeping at least a mile distance. The chase ran over the River Trent, where the lights of the huge sugar refinery glowed away to their right, then into Newark itself. It was just short of 3 o'clock. Inside the town, the signal wavered wildly as the pursuer car swerved through the streets. The blip seemed to settle on the A46 towards Lincoln, and the cars were half a mile up the road before Joe slammed on the brakes.
"He's away to our right," he said. "Distance increasing."
"Turn back," said Preston. They found the turn-off inside Newark. The target had gone down the A17, southeast again, towards Sleaford. In Chesterfield, the police operation moved on the Stefanides house at 2:55. There were 10 uniformed officers, fronted by 2 special branch men in plain clothes. 10 minutes earlier, and they would have had the 2 Soviet agents cold. It was just bad luck. At the moment the SB men approached the door, it opened. The Greek brothers were apparently preparing to leave in their car with their radio to make the transmission that was encoded and recorded inside the transmitter. Andreas Stefanides was coming out to start their car when he saw the policeman. Spiridon was behind him, carrying the transmitter. Andreas gave a single yell of alarm, stepped back and slammed the door. The police charged, shoulders first. When the door came down, Andreas was behind and under it. He came out fighting like an animal in the narrow hallway, and it took 2 officers to flatten him again. The special branch men stepped over the melee, had a quick glance through the ground floor rooms, called to the 2 men in the back garden, who had seen no one emerge, and ran up the stairs. The bedrooms were empty. They found Spiridon in the tiny loft beneath the eaves. The transmitter was on the floor. A flex from it was plugged into a wall socket, and a small red light on the console glowed. He came quietly. At Menworth Hill, GCHQ listening post intercepted a single squirt from the covert transmitter and logged it at 02:58 in the morning of Thursday, 11th of June. Triangulation was immediate and pointed to a spot in the western end of the town of Chesterfield. The police station there was alerted at once, and the call was patched through to the car being used by Superintendent King. He took the call and told Menworth Hill, "Oh no, we've got them." In Moscow, the warrant officer radio operator removed his headphones and nodded towards the teleprinter. "Faint, but clear," he said. The printer began to chatter, sending out a screed of paper covered in a jumble of meaningless letters. When it fell silent, the officer beside the radio tore off the sheet and fed it through the decoder, already set to the formula of the agreed one-time pad. The decoder absorbed the sheet, its computer ran through the permutations, and it delivered the message in clear. The officer read the text and smiled. He telephoned a number, identified himself, checked the identity of the man he was addressing, and said, "Aurora is go." After Newark, the countryside flattened and the wind increased. The pursuit entered the gently rolling wolds of Lincolnshire and the arrow straight roads that lead into the fen country. The flashing blip was steady and strong, leading Preston's two cars down the A17, past Sleaford, towards the Wash and the county of Norfolk. Southeast of Sleaford, Piotrowski stopped again, scanning the dark horizon behind him for lights. There were none. A mile behind him, the pursuers waited in darkened silence. When the blip began to move up the oscilloscope screen, they followed again. At the village of Sutterton, there was another moment of confusion. Two roads led out of the far side of the sleeping township, the A16 due south for Spalding, and the A17 southeast for Long Sutton and King's Lynn across the border in Norfolk. It took 2 minutes to discern that the flashing blip was moving definitely down the A17 towards Norfolk. The gap had increased to 3 miles. "Close up," ordered Preston, and Joe kept the speedometer needle on the figure of 90 until the gap was back to 1.5 miles. South of King's Lynn, they crossed the spread of the River Ouse, and seconds later the blip took the road due south from the bypass towards Downham Market and Thetford. "Where the hell's he going?" grumbled Joe. "He's got a base down there somewhere," said Preston from behind him. "Just keep tracking." To their left, a flash of pink dusted the eastern horizon, and the silhouettes of the passing trees became clearer. Joe went from the headlamps to sidelights. Far to the south, the lights were also dimmed on the columns of coaches as they growled on choked roads through the Suffolk market town of Bury St. Edmunds. There were 200 of them, converging from a variety of different directions across the country, packed to the windows with the marchers. Other demonstrators came in cars, motorcycles, bicycles, and on foot. The slow cavalcade, hung with its banners and placards, moved out of the town and up the A143 to come to rest at Ixworth Junction. Down the narrow lanes, the coaches could go no further. They stopped on the verge of the main road, close to the junction, and discharged their yawning cargoes onto the brightening dawn of the Suffolk countryside. The marshals then began to urge and cajole the throng into some semblance of a column, while the Suffolk police sat astride their motorcycles and watched. In London, the lights were still burning. Sir Bernard Hemmings had been driven from his home, alerted, as he had requested, when the watcher teams in Chesterfield began to follow their man. He was in the basement radio room at Cork Street, with Brian Harcourt Smith beside him. Across the city, Sir Nigel Irvine was in his office at Sentinel House, also roused at his own request. Beneath him in the basement, Bludwyn had sat for half the night and stared at the face of a man beneath a street lamp in a small Derbyshire town. She had been driven from her Camden Town home in the small hours, and had only agreed to come on the personal request of Sir Nigel himself. He had greeted her personally with flowers. For him, she would walk over broken glass, but for no one else.
"He's never been here before," she had said, as soon as she set eyes on the photograph, "and yet..."
After an hour, it was to the Middle East that she turned her attention, and at 4 she had him. It was a contribution from the Israeli Mossad 6 years ago, a bit blurred and just the one picture. Even the Mossad had not been sure. The accompanying text made it plain it was only a suspicion. One of their men had taken it on the streets of Damascus. The man had been Timothy Donnelly then, salesman for Waterford Crystal. On a hunch, the Mossad had snapped him and checked with their people in Dublin. Timothy Donnelly existed, but he was not in Damascus. By the time this was learned, the man in the picture had vanished. He had never surfaced again.
"That's him," she said. "The ears prove it. He should have worn a hat."
Sir Nigel called the basement in Cork Street. "We think we have a make, Bernard," he said. "We can run you off a print and send it over."
He almost lost him 6 miles south of King's Lynn. The pursuit cars were heading south to Downham Market when the blip began to drift, imperceptibly at first, towards the east. Preston consulted his road map.
"He's turned off back there onto the A134, he said, "heading for Thetford. Take a left here."
They got on the trail again at Stradsett, and then it was a straight run through the thickening forests of beech, oak, and pine to Thetford. They had reached the top of Gallows Hill and could see the ancient market town spread out ahead of them in the dim light of dawn when Joe slewed to a halt. He stopped again. Another check for a tail? He had always done that in open countryside before.
Where is he?
Joe studied the range indicator and pointed ahead. Right in the heart of the town, John. Preston conned the road map. Apart from the road they were on, there were five others leading out of Thetford. It was like a star. The daylight was growing. It was 5 o'clock.
Preston yawned. We'll give him 10.
The blip never moved for 10 minutes. Nor another 5. Preston sent his second car around the ring road. From 4 points, the second car triangulated with the first. The blip was right in the centre of Thetford.
Preston picked up the hand mic. Okay, I think we have his base. We're moving in.
The two cars closed on the centre of the town. They converged on Magdalen Street and at 5:25 found the hollow square of lock-up garages. Joe manoeuvred the nose of the car until it pointed unswervingly at one of the doors. The tension among the men began to mount.
He's in there, said Joe.
Preston climbed out. He was joined by Barney and Ginger from the other car.
Ginger, can you lose that door handle?
For answer, Ginger took a spark plug spanner from the toolkit in one of the cars, slipped it over the garage door handle, and jerked it sharply. There was a crack inside the lock. He looked at Preston, who nodded. Ginger swept the up and over garage door open and stood hastily back. The men in the yard just stared. The motorcycle occupied the centre of the garage on its stand. From a hook hung a set of black leathers and a crash helmet. A pair of jackboots stood near the wall. In the dust and oil on the floor were the tracks of a pair of small motorcar tyres.
Oh, Jesus, said Harry Birkinshaw. It's a switchover.
Joe leaned out of his window. Cork just came on the police network. They say they have a full-faced picture. Where do you want it sent?
Thetford Police Station, said Preston. He gazed up at the clear blue sky above him. Then it's too late, he whispered.
Chapter 22. Just after 5, the marchers were finally in a column, 7 men abreast and over a mile long. The head of the column began to move up the narrow road from Ixworth Junction, called the A1088, their destination the village of Little Fakenham, and thence down the even narrower lane to the Royal Air Force Base at Honington. It was a bright, sunny morning, and they were all in good spirits despite the early hour, which had been decreed by the organisers so as to catch the first arrival of the American Galaxy transports bringing in the cruise missiles. As the head of the column began to surge between the hedgerows flanking the road, the body of the crowd started the ritual chant, "No to cruise, Yanks out." Years earlier, RAF Honington had been a base for tornado strike bombers and had attracted no attention from the nation as a whole. It was left to the villagers of Little Fakenham, Honington and Sapperston to tolerate the howling of the tornadoes over their heads. The decision to create at Honington Britain's third cruise missile base had changed all that. The tornadoes had gone to Scotland, but in their place the peace of the rustic neighbourhood had been shattered by protesters, mainly female and possessed of the strangest personal habits, who had infested the fields and set up shanty camps on patches of common land. That had been going on for 2 years. There had been marcher demonstrations before, but this was to be the biggest. Press and television were in heavy attendance, the cameraman running backwards up the road to film the dignitaries in the front rank. These included 3 members of the Shadow Cabinet, 2 bishops, a Monsignor, various luminaries of the Reformed churches, 5 trade union leaders, and 2 noted academics. Behind them came the column of pacifists, conscientious objectors, clerics, Quakers, students, pro-Soviet Marxist-Leninists, anti-Soviet Trotskyites, lecturers and labour activists, with an admixture of unemployed, punks, gays and bearded ecologists. There were also hundreds of equally concerned housewives, working men, teachers and schoolchildren.
Up the two sides of the road were scattered the resident female protesters, most supporting placards and banners, some in anoraks and crew cuts, who held hands with their younger lady friends or clapped the approaching marchers. The whole column was preceded by two police motorcycle outriders. By 5:15, Valery Piotrowski was clear of Thetford and, as usual, was motoring sedately south down the A1088 to pick up the main road to Ipswich and home. He had been up all night and was tired, but he knew his message must have been sent by 3:30, and Moscow would know he had not let them down. He crossed the border into Suffolk, near Euston Hall, and noted a police motorcyclist stationary by the side of the road astride his machine. It was the wrong road and the wrong hour. He had motored this road many times over the previous months, and he had never seen a police patrolman on it. A mile later, at Little Fagenham, all his animal senses went to full alert. Two White Rover police cars were parked on the northern side of the village. Beside them, a group of senior officers were in consultation with two more motorcycle patrolmen. They glanced up at him as he drove by, but made no move to stop him. The move came later, at Ixworth Thorpe. He had just cleared the village itself and was approaching its church on the right-hand side when he saw the police motorcycle leaning against the hedge and the figure of a patrolman in the centre of the road, arm raised to stop him. He began to slow, his right hand dropping to the map pocket inside the door panel, where, under a rolled woolen sweater, lay the Finnish automatic. If it was a trap, he was boxed from behind, but the policeman seemed alone. There was no one else nearby, radio held to mouth. He slowed to a halt. The towering figure in black vinyl strolled to his driver's window and bent down. Piotrowski found himself confronting a ruddy Suffolk face with no hint of guile in it.
"Could I ask you to pull over at the side of the road, please, sir? Just there, in front of the church. Then you'll come to no harm."
So it was a trap. The threat was thinly veiled. But why was there no one else about?
"What seems to be the trouble, officer?" "Rain the road's blocked a bit further down, sir. We'll have it clear directly."
Truth or trick? There might be an overturned tractor down there. He decided not to shoot the policeman and make a dash for it. Not yet. He nodded, let in the clutch, and pulled the car onto the lay-by in front of the church. Then he waited. In his mirror he could see the policeman taking no more notice of him, but signalling another saloon into the same lay-by.
This could be it, he thought. Counterintelligence. But there was only one man in the other car. It stopped behind him. The man climbed out.
"What's going on?"
he called to the policeman. Piotrowski could hear them through his open window.
"You heard, sir. It's a demonstration. Been in all the papers and the telly." "Oh, hell," said the other driver. "I didn't realise it was this road, or at this hour."
"They won't take long to pass," said the policeman comfortingly. "No more than an hour."
At that moment, the head of the column came into sight round the bend. Piotrowski gazed at the banners in the distance and heard the faint shouts with disgust and contempt. He climbed out to watch. The hollow square of tarmac off Magdalen Street, with its 30 lock-up garages, was becoming crowded. Minutes after the discovery of the abandoned garage, Preston had sent Barney and the second car racing up Grove Lane to the police station to ask for help. There had been a duty constable in the front office at that hour, and a sergeant having tea in the back. Simultaneously, Preston had called up London on the police network, and even though it was an open circuit and he would normally have used the cover parlance of a car hire company, he threw caution to the winds and spoke in clear to Sir Bernard himself. "I need backup from the police forces of Norfolk and Suffolk," he said. "Also a chopper, sir. Very fast, or it's all over." He had spent the waiting 20 minutes studying the large-scale road map of East Anglia spread on the bonnet of Joe's car. After 5 minutes, a Thetford motorcycle patrolman, raised by his station sergeant, drifted into the yard, shut off his engine and parked his bike. He walked over to Preston, easing off his helmet as he did so.
"You're the gentleman from London?" he asked. "Anything I can do to help?" "Unless you're a magician," sighed Preston. "Barney arrived back from the police station. Here's a photograph, John. Came through while I was talking to the DS."
Preston studied the handsome young face taken on a Damascus street.
"You bastard,"
he muttered. His words were drowned, so no one else heard. Two American F-111 strike bombers raced towards the town in tight formation, low, heading east. The howl of their engines broke the calm of the waking borough. The policeman did not glance up.
Barney, standing beside Preston, followed their progress out of sight. "Noisy sods," he said.
"Ah, they always be coming over Thetford," said the local copper. "After a while, come from Lakenheath."
"London airport's bad enough," said Barney, who lived at Hounslow, "but at least the airliners don't fly that low. I don't think I could live with that for long."
"Don't mind them, just as long as they stay up in the air," said the policeman, unwrapping a chocolate bar. "Wouldn't like one to crash, though. They carry atomic bombs, they do. Small, mind."
Preston turned slowly round. "What did you say?" he asked. Out of Cork Street, MI5 had been working fast. Dispensing with the usual liaison from the legal adviser, Sir Bernard Hemmings had personally called both the assistant chief constables crime for the counties of Norfolk and Suffolk. The officer in Norwich was still abed, but in Ipswich his opposite number was already in his office because of the demonstration that was tying up half the Suffolk force. The ACC for Norfolk was reached at the same time as the call to him from Thetford Police Station came through. He authorised complete cooperation. The paperwork would follow later. Brian Harcourt Smith was chasing up a helicopter. Britain's two intelligence agencies have call on a special flight of so-called dedicated helicopters, held at Northolt, outside London. It is possible to call one up in a hurry, but normally advance arrangements are made. The Deputy Director General's urgent inquiry brought the answer that a chopper could be airborne in 40 minutes, and at Thetford 40 after that. Harcourt Smith asked Northolt to hold on. 80 minutes, he said to Sir Bernard. The DG happened to be talking to the ACC of Suffolk in his Ipswich office. "Would you have a police helicopter available right now?" he asked the Suffolk officer. There was a pause while the ACC consulted his colleague in traffic control on an internal line. "We have one in the air over Bury St. Edmunds," he said.
"Please get it to Thetford and take aboard one of our officers," said Sir Bernard. "It's a matter of national security, I assure you."
"I'll give the order now," said the ACC of Suffolk.
Preston beckoned the Thetford policeman across to his car.
"Point out to me the American air bases around here," he said. The patrolman put a thick finger on the map.
"Well, they're a bit all over, sir. There's Sculthorpe up here in North Norfolk, Lakenheath and Mildon Hall out here to the west, Chicksands and Bedfordshire, though I do believe they don't fly out of there any more, and then there's Bentwaters here on the Suffolk coast near Woodbridge."
It was 6 o'clock. The marchers swirled around the two-parked cars on the lay-by in front of the Church of All Saints, a tiny but beautiful building, old as the village, thatched with Norfolk reed and without electric light, so that evensong is still held by candlelight. Piotrowski stood by his car, watching them amble by, arms crossed, his face bland. His private thoughts were venomous. Across the fields behind him, a traffic-control helicopter clattered north, but he failed to hear it for the chanting of the marchers.
The other car driver, who turned out to be a biscuit salesman returning home from a seminar on the sales appeal of Butter Osborne's, walked over to him. He nodded towards the marchers.
"Arseholes," he muttered above the chant of "No to cruise, Yanks out."
The Russian smiled and nodded. Getting no further reaction, the salesman wandered back to his own car, climbed in, and began to read his stack of promotional literature.
If Valery Piotrowski had had a more developed sense of humour, he might have smiled at his situation. He was standing in front of the church of a god in whom he did not believe, in a country he was seeking to destroy, giving passage to people he heartily despised. And yet, if his mission was successful, all the marchers' demands would be fulfilled. He sighed as he thought of the speedy way his own country's MVD troops would deal with this march, before handing over the ringleaders to the lads in the 5th Chief Directorate for an extended question-and-answer session down at Lefortovo. Preston stared down at the map on which he had ringed the 5 American air bases. "If I were an illegal, living in a foreign country under deep cover and on a mission," he thought, "I would want to hide myself in a large town or city. In Norfolk there were King's Lynn, Norwich, and Yarmouth. In Suffolk, Lowestoft, Bury St. Edmunds, and Ipswich. To get back to King's Lynn, close to USAF Sculthorpe, the man he was chasing would have driven back past him at Gallows Hill. No one had. That left 4 bases, 3 away to the west and 1 in the south.
He considered the line of the Rye that had brought his quarry from Chesterfield to Thetford, due southeast all the way. It would be logical to sight the switchover point from motorcycle to car somewhere along the line of travel. From Lakenheath and Mildenhall to the transmitter house at Chesterfield, it would have been more logical to rent a lock-up garage in Ely or Peterborough en route for the Midlands. He took the line southeast from the Midlands to Thetford,